thank you all for coming this evening. My name is Rod Finkel. I'm the president of the council. Now I'd like to introduce the head table. To my far left is Sam Combs. Sam is a member of the board of directors, and he is a past president. Sitting next to him is David Gottstein. David is the president of Dynamic Capital Management, and he is also the chairman, the Alaska chairman for the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. And Dave is going to do our honors tonight. Would you please introduce our guest?
Thank you, Rod. It's my pleasure to be here and to help introduce the Consul General from Israel, who's based in San Francisco. I'm going to give you the official introduction, and then I'm going to give you my personal introduction. But just so that you know the facts, Akiva is the Consul General of Israel for the Pacific Northwest and has been since August of 2008. He served as World Jewish Affairs Advisor to the President of Israel, as Director of the Israel Economic and Cultural Office in Taipei, as Deputy Director for Palestinian Affairs in the Israel Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and as Press Information Attaché at the Israel Embassy in The Hague. He is a graduate of the Harvard University School of Government and holds degrees from Hebrew University in Jewish Political Thought and from Columbia University in General Philosophy. He has written and lectured extensively on Jewish values in the foreign policy of Israel and on ethical considerations in international relations. He served as a paratrooper in the Israeli Defense Forces and as an infantry captain in the IDF Reserves. He is interested in running, I'm assuming that's not for elected office, mountain biking and ascending high places. Akiva is married to Naomi, who I'll introduce in a moment, and community social worker, and they have four children, Yona, Zohar, Yehuda, and Roni. And so my personal introduction is that in the last couple of years that I've been able to work with Akiva, I found him to be not only a gifted diplomat, but exceptionally well-informed and a really good person. I think it's your third trip to Alaska, and this time he was able to bring his beautiful wife, Naomi, and we're having enough influence on him that we're lobbying him to bring his whole family, and I think we're making some good progress. They had a beautiful drive down Turnagain Arm today, so I want to welcome the Consul General Akiva, and let's give him a nice welcome.
Thank you. Hi. So, students, the first rule is not to sit in the back row. So if you got to sit in the back row, then turn your chairs around. And anyway, welcome. And welcome, everyone. Thank you very much for the invitation. So I'd like to thank the Alaska World Affairs Council for making this event happen. And I'd like to thank you citizens of Alaska for living in this great place. For the first time, I really got an opportunity to... We did a lot of work here. I met with Governor Parnell this morning. But in the afternoon, there were a couple hours free, and I got to go with my wife and a friend named Ira to see to Portage, where we saw the glacier. And I think it's just an incredible privilege to live in this part of the United States, and a little jealous of you on that one. So thank you for living here and for taking good care of this natural resource. I'd also like to thank David for everything. And so, thank you. My plan is to speak for approximately 30 minutes to make a general presentation and then to open this up for a general discussion. And please feel free to ask me anything, and we will have a democratic and open conversation. I'm going to start, though, with your permission. I don't know how many of you were here last week, but I feel it behooves me to say a few words about the speaker, Ms. Allison Weir, who was here last week. It's basically like this. I feel, with respect and with love to the World Affairs Council, that an inadvertent mistake was made. The reason I say that is the following. It would be fine to invite an Iranian diplomat, a Libyan diplomat. It would be fine who represents the national interests of their country and of a legitimate government. And it would be fine to invite Noam Chomsky, who represents a view which I completely disagree with, but it reflects a certain intellectual grounding and a certain ideological grounding. That's all fine. But the person who was here, and in general, by the way, I do not believe that people who oppose Zionism or oppose the State of Israel do not have a right to make those arguments. Arnold Toynbee, very important British historian, was an anti-Zionist for all kinds of historic reasons, and he was a fundamentally decent and brilliant man, although I and others disagree with him. But the speaker who was here last week, it's a different story. She is a person who practices race hatred. And she is cited on David Duke's website. She is a person whose beliefs fundamentally in one of her articles, which appears on her website right now, she accuses the Jewish people of using Christian blood during the Middle Ages, which is the blood libel, which was debunked 100 million times and is one of the basis, one of the classical examples of hatred of the Jewish people. And she uses it as her argument, or to strengthen her argument, that the Israeli army is stealing organs from Palestinians. She also is of the belief that the Jewish people are running the world, and that the Jewish people and Israel are using oligarchs in Russia to destroy the Russian state, and are using neocons in Washington to take the United States into wars at Israel's behest. This is just anti-Semitic belief, and it predates Zionism. It was held by Henry Ford in the 1920s and by Father Coughlin in 1938 and 1939. It's got nothing to do with Israel or Zionism. It's simply a form of race hatred. So I feel I had to make these remarks, and I know it's heavy, and what can I say? I think a mistake was made, and I respect your organization, and I know you'll find the way to make it right. What I'd like to do now is to talk about the Middle East. Let's start with geography. So we have in front of us the Middle East pretty much. It starts in the Atlantic Ocean with Morocco, and it goes into the Persian Gulf, although there is a mistake on this map. Iran is not part of the Middle East. An Arab state. It's not, strictly speaking, a part of the Middle East, but it is an Islamic republic and part of the equation. And in the middle, you see Israel, which is a small country. I think it's often important to point this out because when you look at the volume of news which is generated about Israel, from Israel, because of Israel, one would imagine that we are at least the size of Sudan or Saudi Arabia, but indeed we are after Lebanon, the smallest state in the Middle East. In fact, we are 21,000 square kilometers. I did the math, and I don't think I got it wrong. I think we fit into Alaska approximately 72 times. So we are a little place. We also have narrow geography, and it's important. I bring this as a basis because it's important to realize what the dimensions are when we talk about the issues. So what we have here in dark blue, we have the West Bank. And in light blue, this is the West Bank over here. This is the Gaza Strip. And those are the Golan Heights. Now, if you look at the Mediterranean Sea, you'll see that from Tel Aviv, where our international airport is, and it's our largest and most important commercial city, from Tel Aviv to the border of the West Bank is 11 miles. That's exactly what it is. And you can see that Jerusalem borders right on the West Bank. You can see that from the northern tip of the Gaza Strip to one of our most important ports, Ashkelon, it's 7 miles. And from there to Beersheba, it's about 25 miles, and missiles hit there from the Gaza Strip in the last war. So we're talking about a place which is small, extremely compact, basically the exact opposite of the Alaskan experience. And it doesn't mean that arrangements can't happen and we can't work things out, but it's important to understand this when we look at things. So What happened? What is Israel was established in 1948. And what I'd like to do is to start basically with the fundamental UN resolution which established Israel, and to reiterate what Israel's fundamental position is vis-a-vis the Palestinian people today. The United Nations said in the partition resolution adopted in 1947 and which came into effect in May 1948 that in the area of Palestine, basically from the Jordan River until the Mediterranean, there are two peoples with contradictory national aspirations. There are the Jewish people who seek to reestablish a Jewish state, and there are the Arab people of Palestine who seek to establish an Arab state, or what we, at that time, it was not called Palestinian, because in the UN parlance of the 1940s, there were Palestinian Jews and there were Palestinian Arabs. But to translate it into the modern language, and there are Palestinian Arabs who would like to establish a Palestinian state. And hence, there should be two states here. The position of David Ben-Gurion, the leader of the Zionist movement and the first prime minister of Israel, was, we accept the partition resolution. This land should be divided. There will be a Jewish state, and there will be an Arab state between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. The Arab side entirely, the Arab League, the established Arab states, and the Arabs of Palestine rejected that, and then broke out the first Arab-Israeli war, what we call Israel's War of Independence. That was in 1948. Now we are in 2009. And our position, the position of the Israeli government, has not changed. We believe that there should be two states. There should be a Palestinian state where the Palestinians will realize their national aspirations, and there should be Israel in which the Jewish people will realize their national aspirations. Now, we don't say for a moment that within Israel there will not be Israeli Arabs, Christians, people who are non-Jews who will be citizens of Israel. In fact, that is the situation of Israel today. Israel is about 7.2 million people. Of that, 21% are non-Jews, the majority of them Israeli Arabs with full citizen rights. But we believe that that is part of Israel, and we want to have large and significant minorities within our country, but Palestinian nationality should be realized within Palestine. Palestine, where will it be? Well, here we enter into a negotiation with the Palestinian people, where the Palestinians are demanding the entire West Bank and the Gaza Strip, a return to the 1967 borders. That's the position of the Palestinian Authority. Our position is that there should be some border adjustments given 60 years. But we are not that far away from a possibility of an agreement. We fundamentally agree. That's where we got to in the Oslo Accords of 1993, and that's where we still need to get to today. So, if the Palestinian leadership and the Israeli leadership agree on fundamentals, why are we not reaching an agreement? There are a number of things which are blocking it at present. I would start with the following. The most fundamental problem is that at this moment there is a divided Palestinian leadership. In the West Bank, we have the Palestinian Authority, which is an elected Palestinian government, which was established. It inherited the Palestinian leadership from the PLO and the Fatah movement. It won elections, and it was led by Yasser Arafat. Today it's led by Abu Mazen. They are in power in the West Bank. In Gaza, Hamas movement, which is also a Palestinian nationalist movement, but it's also one which is Islamic and fundamentalist in its orientation, has taken control. There was a short civil war between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority was ejected from there, and right now the Hamas is ruling the Gaza Strip. What that means, now Hamas does not recognize Israel. It does not recognize any of the agreements that we've signed. And hence, this creates a problem for moving towards a resolution. Egypt is involved in a mediation between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority on reaching some sort of agreement where the state of two Palestinian governments will change, and there will again be some sort, they will agree to perhaps hold new elections and to reunite and to recognize one Palestinian president. That is something that would be very helpful for us to be able to move to a resolution and a final peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. We hope it'll happen, but I have to admit that from the Israeli perspective, there are also challenges, because what will happen if there will be Palestinian national elections and Hamas will win them, which I don't think would happen today, by the way, but let's say that would happen, and would reject all the peace agreements and would not reject the idea of any sort of accommodation with Israel, then we would be back to the drawing board. So, again, Israel accepts the idea of a Palestinian state alongside us. The fundamental problem right now is that Hamas is ruling Gaza. It creates a problem for the Palestinian Authority to negotiate with us. We hope that this will move forward, and that, but there's a limit to what we can do within Palestinian internal politics, and we hope they will work this out. Now I'd like to say a few words about Lebanon. Lebanon is on the top. Lebanon, the southern part of Lebanon, is occupied by Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a Shiite movement. It's also a political movement in Lebanon. It participates in Lebanese elections. They did not win the last elections, but they're an important minority group. Our problem is that they are also running their own army, and they pretty much do what they want. At the end of the Second Lebanon War in 2006, there was a United Nations Resolution 1701, which ended hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah. At that time, it was decided that southern Lebanon would be demilitarized, and this would be overseen by a UN force. In the last 4 months, there have been two incidents of huge explosions in homes in southern Lebanon, and these are its weapons stockpiling by Hezbollah. So we have a problem there. Hezbollah is rearming, but we, from our, as Israel is defending itself from our border. If we will not be attacked, neither will we retaliate. Syria. Well, with Syria, and I know this is all kind of complicated, but I'm assuming that you're absorbing everything, and but we can retalk it over afterwards. With Syria, the truth is that neither Israel, neither my government, nor the government of Syria are very, very, neither of us are rushing into peace talks very urgently. We're fairly happy with the status quo, and they can tolerate the status quo, and neither of us really wants to do or take the steps which might be necessary for a peace agreement between us. From our perspective, we are on the Golan Heights. It's not a moral dilemma. It's a legal dilemma in the sense that the Golan Heights is territory captured from Syria, but it's not full of Syrian citizens. We are not an occupying power on the Golan Heights. It was basically pretty much empty savanna land. On the other hand, we really would prefer not to return it. It's strategic high ground, and what we'll get is probably a very, very cold peace from Damascus. And so we're pretty much okay with the way things are. Bashar Assad, the president of Syria, he knows what we demand for a peace agreement. We demand from a peace agreement that Syria cut their ties with Iran, not cutting diplomatic relations, but cutting their strategic relations, and that they allow Lebanon to, the Lebanese government, to assert itself, and they stop allowing weapons to come to Hezbollah and stop encouraging Hezbollah all the time. We also need them to publicly make peace with us and not secretly. In other words, for Bashar Assad to meet with his Israeli counterparts openly and to declare that there is peace between us. And that's something that he doesn't really want to do. So we're kind of dancing around each other, and it's kind of convenient for both sides. the primary, and this is going to be the last foreign policy. This is going to be the sort of like the end of my presentation that I'm going to open it up. The last country involved in this equation is not on this map. And so let me take it back. And that is Iran. Iran is, from Israel's national security perspective, our number one issue, problem, dilemma today. The reason is because the Iranian government is working hard to achieve nuclear weaponry. They've been trying to do this for a long time, about 15 years, and they're moving forward. They're moving forward at three different levels. They're moving forward at the level of uranium enrichment, where they have mastered the technology of the nuclear fuel cycle. They know how to build advanced centrifuges, and there are about 7,000 of those centrifuges which are spinning 24 hours a day. And their only purpose, their only possible purpose, the only reason that a government would expend so much effort to build so many centrifuges is in order to enrich uranium to weapons grade. At the same time, they're also working on weaponization. Weaponization means the ability to take enriched uranium, highly enriched uranium, and to put it into a casing that will explode and create a fission explosion when sitting on atop a missile. That's called weaponization, building a nuclear warhead. And the third aspect of their program, which they are also pursuing, is the development of strategic missile capacity. Right now, Iran has the ability to build, manufacture, and launch intermediate-range ballistic missiles, which can reach from Iran to Israel, but also to Turkey and to Greece. And they are working on a full ICBM capacity, which will be able to reach the rest of Europe and also the United States. So, now, okay, there are other countries which also have done this, Pakistan, India, but Iran is led by a regime which is, frankly, quite scary, and things have changed and gotten worse since the summer. There were elections for the Iranian presidency this summer. President Ahmadinejad won them. We believe that it was a fraudulent election, and there's lots and lots of evidence that maybe up to 40% of the vote was forged. But in any case, what's happened is that a country which was led by an Islamic theocracy, which we weren't so, from our perspective, we weren't so crazy about that one either, because they also didn't accept our right to exist. But now, even the clerics, the conservative clerics, who nevertheless had some pragmatism to them. In other words, they may have believed that Israel should be wiped out, but they did not believe that the divine presence would come down and necessarily help them do it. They're all shelved. And the country is being run by President Ahmadinejad with the support of the Revolutionary Guard. So it's turning from an Islamic theocracy into an Islamic military dictatorship. And a very, very closed system. It's not North Korea, but it's a very, very closed system, which is much less responsive to the reality of the international system. So what to do about it? What to do about this dilemma? Our feeling is the following. And Israel finds itself in a particular dilemma because we try to convince everyone that this is a threat to the entire world, not only to us. And yet it's undeniable that we are in the first line of the threat. So even if all of Europe is threatened, and nevertheless, we're threatened first. So that's a dilemma for us. On the one hand, we've got to get the entire international community mobilized. On the other hand, we're the front runners. So we're going to get smacked in the face first. We have to convince all the people who are going to get smacked in the face second and third that they ought to help us now. What we believe needs to happen is the following. We believe that the diplomacy which is going on right now, on October 1, there was a meeting between the members of the Security Council plus Germany with Iranian negotiators. And the next meeting will take place 3 days from now on October 18th to try to convince Iran to stop enriching uranium. We don't know exactly what happened in the first meeting. It's unclear exactly what was agreed. If that will work, great. Our belief is that it will probably not work. I think my guess is that's also the belief of Secretary of State Clinton. But if that will work, fantastic. If it will not work, then it's important to delimit the amount of time which will be given to diplomacy, to delimit it and to say exactly how much time is given to diplomacy before moving on to next steps. Because if we will say that we're willing to negotiate forever, if the international community will say that, then the Iranians will find the way to drag it out until there's a nuclear explosion somewhere in the Indian Ocean. And an Iranian device is a fait accompli and has been tested already. So we think that United States, the European powers, everyone who is involved in this negotiation should say to Iran, there will be a certain date by which we will either reach an agreement or next steps. What could be next steps? The proper next steps, which it's a belief of Israel they should be prepared already now, is very, very strong economic sanctions. The reason that we believe that economic sanctions have a chance to work is for the following reason. We believe that the only thing that will stop the Iranian government, the current Iranian government, from pursuing a nuclear weapon is a threat to its own survival. In other words, if they have to choose behind the bomb and no longer being in charge, that's the only thing that will stop them. And the only thing that can create that kind of pressure on Iran would be the type of economic sanctions that could nearly collapse the Iranian economy. The Iranian economy is based primarily on the export of oil and on government subsidies, which are given to large amounts of the population. And that's got to, the pressure has to be there. How could a sanctions regime look? It could have the architecture of such a sanctions regime would probably include three different types of sanctions. Sanction number one would be to stop all investment in the Iranian energy sector. In other words, don't allow Iran to develop its oil and gas fields anymore. Stop that. The United States has already stopped. In other words, there's already federal law that a U.S. company cannot be invested in the Iranian energy sector over $20 million. But the U.S. economy can invest in foreign companies that are working the Iranian oil fields. And so probably what we need is a much, much wider umbrella of this kind of sanction in which Russia, China, the states of Europe and the United States would say no more investment, period. We have to divest from the Iranian energy sector. That could be sanction number one. Sanction number two, which has already been put into some sort of legislative language, would be to keep Iran. Iran is a net oil exporter, but its ability to refine its own petroleum is limited, and it has to import a large amount of its petroleum in refined form in order to run its factories and to run its cars. And that would be to stop the import into Iran of refined petroleum. Other steps, which would be third, all kinds of financial moves to sanction the Iranian central bank, to find all kinds of ways to stop Iran from being able to have insurance on trade insurance. The Trade Commissioner of California is talking about getting all insurance companies licensed in California to divest from Iran because it's risky. It's risky to be invested there. So these are all kinds of steps that could bring very heavy pressure to bear on the Iranian regime to stop pursuing a nuclear weapon. I think Alaska could do its part as well, actually. You have a large investment portfolio, and I think it's one of those cases. Oftentimes, the situation is that to do the right thing is not to do the profitable thing. And to do what is prudent financially is not always to do what is prudent ethically. But in this case, I think everything comes together, because to invest in Iran at this time is foolhardy. So if you know anyone on the investment board, talk to them. I think there is another issue that maybe we'll talk about in the framework of questions. Israel is struggling with something going on in the United Nations right now, and that is the Goldstone Report, which was a report it was commissioned by the Human Rights Council in Geneva, a body which is actually staffed by countries which do most of the human rights violations in the world. And now Libya has asked for this report to be dealt with in the Security Council, Libya, which just brought the Lockerbie bomber home. But in any case, the report accuses Israel and Hamas of committing war crimes during the Gaza operation. We are very, very angry at the report and completely disagree with it. But I think I'll stop talking at this point, and we can talk about it more if there are questions about it. So thank you very much for your attention.
Consul General Tor will take your questions directly. Please wait till the microphone gets to you, and please keep the questions direct. This is not a time for presentation.
Two very direct questions. You didn't speak about Egypt, so would you speak to the relationship between Israel and Egypt? And secondly, if one is to believe the media, and I don't always, there appears to be a developing relationship between supporters of Israel and what is characterized as right-wing fundamentalist Christians. How do you react to that potential alliance?
Okay. Well, I guess, you know, I should have spoken about Egypt, but there, things are okay. By the way, I didn't talk about Jordan as well, where things are okay. We have a peace agreement with Egypt since 1979, or actually 1981, but it began during the Camp David process. It's a cold peace. We're unhappy about that. There's very little trade between Israel and Egypt. The Egyptian intellectuals oppose the peace treaty with Israel, but basically, Egypt, which is probably the most important country in the Arab world, is at peace with us. And we value that, and we value our relationship with President Mubarak and with the Egyptian people, and we hope that this peace will become warmer. We also have peace with Jordan, and we also hope that that peace will become warmer. But a cold peace is better than a warm war, hot war. Right wing, well, you know, we are happy with the support of Americans of all stripes. It doesn't affect our policies one way or the other, but we do not ask people who support Israel what their religion is and what their beliefs are and what their domestic agenda is in the United States. Unless they're neo-Nazis, in which case we will say no, thank you.
Thank you. From what I've read in the recent Iranian elections, I think the runner-up was Mousavi. And from what I've read, it seemed like of course, he's blood related to the Supreme Guide. And at the moment, Ahmadinejad and the Supreme Guide are, I don't know if the relations are warming up, but from what I've read, it seems like they're kind of at odds with each other. So from what I've seen, things kind of, when they're held in balance, in tension, are happy. But when they're working together, sometimes the best doesn't come out. Like, in a democracy, everything's in tension. That's the way it's supposed to work. And from my perspective, it was kind of scary if Mousavi was elected, that him and the Supreme Guide would be able to, if they had ill intentions, that they could carry those out more efficiently. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on that versus the... the relation of Mousavi to the Supreme Guide versus Ahmadinejad.
And the Supreme Leader, you mean?
Yes, I'm sorry.
So, well, Mousavi is part of the conservative leadership, but he seems to be more of a Democrat, and we would prefer that. I mean, from the perspective of Israel, we would prefer an Iranian republic in which there are Islamic parties, but which would not have a radical agenda as part of its constitution. But failing that, we would prefer a leader who is responsive to the will of the people. And I think that Mousawi is more responsive to the will of the people than President Ahmadinejad. President Ahmadinejad, when he came to the United Nations 2 years ago, he believed that he saw an aura in the room of the General Assembly. That's a problem.
Alison Weir, who was here last week, I would like to ask you, she gave some facts, numbers, statistics, and she didn't give an opinion. She gave things based on facts. I'd like to ask you, what proof do you have that she's anti-Semitic? Because I'm Semitic, and I speak Semitic language. And number two, I think you showed the wrong map of the Middle East. I would like you to please correct that. Israel is the only country in the Middle East that have nuclear weapons. And I would like to see Middle East free nuclear weapons, not just Iran. I'd like to see Israel as well. I'd like to see Israel open its borders to inspectors, where inspectors can go in and search the nuclear facilities.
Okay. Well, let's get to Alison Weir at the end. So what's wrong with the map?
Okay. You said this is the Middle East. Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Egypt, Sudan is not Middle East. It's North Africa. Middle East should be from Syria going this way. Iran is the Middle East, Oman, UAE, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Jordan, Lebanon, Palestine, Israel. But this side here is not Middle East. This is North Africa.
I accept your correction. That's fine. In terms of the second question was about Israel's nuclear weapons. Well, we've never stated that we have. It's possible that we do. It's possible that we don't. We have we've remained completely agnostic about it. But one thing I can tell you is that we never threatened to wipe out another state. That I can say. About Alison Weir. Well, I think I made the case pretty strongly, but here it is. It's her article in which she accuses Jews of using Christian blood during the Middle Ages. And about the second one, well, this is from the website of David Duke, PhD, How the Jewish Supremacists in Media Lie to Us. On Allison's article, Do Americans Even Care? Russia, Israel, and Media Omissions, commentary by David Duke. The following article shows once more how our government is securely in the hands of the Jewish supremacists and how their press supremacy works hand in glove to maintain that supremacy. That's my evidence.
This may be a little off the subject, but I'm wondering what, in your opinion, realistically, what are the chances that some of the developing and developed Asian countries would as well support economic sanctions against Iran, specifically China?
Well, that's a good question, and that's actually a very, very serious foreign policy conundrum right now for the United States and for Israel. And I think not only, also for England, France, and Germany, who support the idea of preparing sanctions and being ready to put them into place. The problem is the following vis-a-vis China. China does not feel threatened by Iran. Even though they have restive Muslim populations, they're not necessarily Shiite populations who are allied with Iran. That's number one. But the primary problem is that China is energy hungry. They need oil. They need natural gas. They have pipelines that are coming from the area of Iran and that are coming to China, and they do not want that to be disrupted. I think in such a situation where there are clearly national interests mitigating against a policy that, from the perspective of the West, is the right policy, it's necessary to speak honestly and to put the cards on the table. When governments speak, and when they are in different parts of the world and they perceive things differently, it's important that they know what is most important to each government. And vis-a-vis China, it's necessary simply to say, this is the way it is seen by these countries. It is a very, very, very an important an issue of number one or number two importance. Please help us if you want us to help you on those issues which are most important to you. The problem is similar with Russia. Russia is not energy hungry. They have their own energy. But they have trade with Iran, and they have all kinds of reasons for, I think, negotiating or working through this crisis in a way which is beneficial to Russia. And it's important to work through it. I think with strong diplomacy, strong U.S. and Western European diplomacy, it may well be possible to bring Russia and China on board. And if not, then it's necessary to work out a sanctions architecture which can work without them. So my answer to your question is that it's an excellent question, and it is actually the foreign policy dilemma, one of the major dilemmas of this moment.
Sir, I just have a quick question. You didn't really seem to mention, you mentioned more about Iran than you did about the specific Israeli region. You didn't mention much about Israel's expansion into the West Bank or the Palestinian right of return. I was wondering if you could elaborate on those issues.
Okay. So right now, Israel captured the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights in 1967 in the Six-Day War. And the question is, what will be the fate of these territories? About the Golan Heights, I think I spoke at length about why neither us or Syria are really moving towards an agreement at this time. We may well do so in the future. With Gaza, well, Israel left Gaza in 2005. We removed all of our settlements. We removed 8,000 Israelis who didn't want to leave. But the Israeli government exercised its sovereignty on its own citizens, and we forced them to leave. And we returned Gaza to Palestinian rule. We hoped that this would actually be a first step towards Palestinian statehood. In other words, there would be Palestinian rule in Gaza, and that would be a model for our leaving the West Bank, or large parts, or the great majority of the West Bank. Unfortunately, things didn't work out that way. I think many Gazans interpreted Israel's leaving Gaza as a kind of surrender rather than an expression of Israel's strength and desire to do things in order to achieve a peace agreement. And Hamas came to power there. So that's a big problem. Vis-a-vis the West Bank, so there is an argument between Israel and the U.S. administration right now about a settlement freeze. And I would say that we probably, on the Israeli side, have not done a very good job in explaining our position, and so let me try to do so now. We agree that the Palestinian state will include large amount of the West Bank. I don't know whether it will be 80%. I don't know if it will be 94%, 97%, or 100%. I don't know what it will be, but it will be somewhere between 80 and 100%. And there will be some sort of land link between the West Bank and Gaza. But since 1967, 42 years have passed. And there are small Israeli settlements in many parts of the West Bank. And frankly, I don't believe that the majority of them will continue to be in the framework of a peace agreement. That probably won't happen. And Israel has already shown that it's able to remove and willing to remove settlements. However, we have a number of very large settlement blocks right around Jerusalem. Here we have the city of Jerusalem has developed. It's our capital. We have neighborhoods which aren't in areas which were captured from Jordan, which was the occupier of the West Bank. And we have areas like the Etzion block, in which in excess 10,000 to 20,000 people are living. We do not believe that those areas should be taken apart. We believe that in the context of a peace agreement, they'll probably be annexed to Israel, and Israel will have to give other territories from within Israel proper to the Palestinians in exchange for that land. It could come from a number of areas. It could come, for example, in the southern West Bank. It could come in the area of the south of the Gaza Strip. Gaza Strip is very, very densely populated. Israel could cede some of its own land to the West Bank in exchange for those areas. So we believe that there will have to be some areas where we agree on land swap. And at this moment, since we have no idea how long peace negotiations will go on for, we're not willing to stop life for tens of thousands of people who are living in East Jerusalem, Israelis who are living in East Jerusalem, and in settlements immediately adjacent to Jerusalem. So we're not willing to tell them that they cannot build an addition to their home or that a school cannot be built there. So we're not willing to do a total settlement freeze. We're willing to do a partial settlement freeze. The position of the Palestinian president, Abu Mazen, he does not accept that. He demands a total and complete settlement freeze, which he did not demand from the previous Israeli government. We consider that not fair. But it's a disagreement between us, and we're trying to work it out. And there's a fellow named George Mitchell, whose full-time salary is to solve this problem. Please, go ahead. A follow-up question is fine by me.
Sir, I also asked you to talk about the Palestinian right of return. I don't think you elaborated on that issue.
Okay. The question was the Palestinian right of return. The Palestinian right of return is a position of some parts of the Palestinian leadership that Palestinian refugees who are outside of the West Bank and Gaza, who are in Lebanon, in Jordan, any other place in the world where a person who was previously an Arab Muslim or an Arab Christian who resided in the West Bank and Gaza or who resided in Israel at some point and has left and is a refugee, more or less, although they might not legally be refugees right now, should have the right to return to the State of Israel to their original homes before 1948 or before 1967. Our position, we oppose that. Again, we believe that the Palestinian state should be the homeland for all Palestinians, and the Israeli state should be the homeland for any Jew who, for all Jews who have sought refuge, and any Jew who wants to live in the nation state of the Jewish people. Our position is based on the following. The way we view it, we think that what happened between Israel and the Palestinian people is very similar to what happened between India and Pakistan in 1948, where there was exchanges of populations. When Israel was established, what you see here on this map, this is actually something which is not well known. What's not well known is that a very, very large percentage of Israel, close to 45 to 50%, are Jews whose parents came from Arab lands. Jews did not only live in Europe, they lived throughout North Africa and the Middle East. And what happened between 1948 and 1967, you had a very, very large movement of Jews from Arab lands to Israel. They came for a number of reasons. In many cases, they came because after Israel was established, it was no longer possible to reside in those states. The hostility was too great. That was the situation in places like Libya, Egypt, and Iraq. There was a huge Jewish population in Iraq that almost entirely came to Israel. They left all of their properties behind, and none of that has ever been returned. In other cases, the Jews of Morocco came. It was a different kind of process. Either they felt pressure or they wanted to live in their nation state. But at the end of the day, a very large amount of Jews came from Arab lands to reside in the state of Israel. And the number appearing on this slide is 800,000, although it's scholars can debate whether it was 700,000 or whether it was 900,000. At the same time, there were also Palestinian refugees. And here scholars put the number at between 600,000 and 1 million. And we believe that just as Palestinian refugees were created, Jewish refugees were created, and each one should live in their own nation state. We believe that the Palestinian right of return is a demand to establish a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza and to establish the possibility of a second Palestinian state within Israel. And we just don't think it's justified.
And I've been to Israel and to the West Bank. I was wondering why that is not a racial or even racist solution to these issues. I've seen the apartness that is there. I've seen the separation, the difference between Israel proper, the West Bank. I have not been to Gaza. And if we're talking about really a Jewish state and a Palestinian state that are separate and are very much separated now for the most part by the separation barrier, as it's called, the fence, the road system that is not available to Palestinians, all this, why would what you're proposing not be a racial or at the very most ethnic solution as opposed to people living in the same country all with political rights and equality?
Well, because for the same reason that French culture and the French people have a right to a French state, and for the same reason that the people of Germany have the right to a German state, and for the same people, the people of Britain have a right to a British state, we believe, Zionism believes, that the Jewish people have a right to a Jewish state.
In the United States, we don't have a state that's a Jewish state. We don't have a state that's a German state. Some states have more Germans or more Poles or more whatever. Why does the rest of the world, even though we now have world populations moving everywhere, why can't the rest of the world just manage to mesh?
I would say the following. I would say when the international system abolishes nation states, then we will abolish our nation state as well. When the United States, Canada, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, China, Taiwan, and Russia and Ukraine become one state, we will join that state as well.
Yeah. Last week's talk left me with some a message, and one of those messages was that there's very unequal treatment. The press treats casualties in the Palestinian territories much differently than they treat casualties, particularly children, in Israel. And the message that I'm going to take home from you is one of intense, very strident character assassination. But I didn't hear you mention anything about that particular issue that was really one of the primary things that Ms. Weir was speaking of.
So wait, I'm not following the question. Your question is, why is the press not...
Well, what I'm saying is that she was talking about how the press treats the Palestinian casualties, particularly children, very differently than Israeli casualties. And I'm wondering why you think that occurs and why you found it necessary to spend so much time in character assassination rather than discussing the issues.
Well, I don't agree with that finding. I mean, when I read the New York Times... I'm not certain that I'm getting a exact approximation of reality, but I'm assuming pretty close approximation to reality. So my tendency is to, and when I read something in the New York Times, which is very critical of Israel, my tendency is to take it very, very seriously and not to say, hey, this is biased. And with all due respect, I did not commit the character assassination. The person committed it on themselves. And I think that I've done nothing more than to present their writings.
On behalf of an Alaskan, I'd like to thank you.
It's a pleasure to come here.
General Tor and your wife and the Israeli consulate for coming to Alaska to educate us. Kind of a multi-part question. How can there be peace when weaponry being inexpensive and precise? How does Israel expect peace when such a small minority can cause such damage? This seems to be a constant damage control for eternity for people that can get these weapons. And this, of course, excludes the four or five majors that have weapons. We're talking about smaller entities that can obtain weapons. And also, in regards to the Pakistani government, which is unstable, how does Israel feel have any concern in regards to those weapons being able to proliferate into the improper hands for very little money?
So I'll phrase it, let's say Hezbollah and Hamas, for example, and Pakistan. All right, so look, we have, in the case of the Gaza Strip, we have a problem of a constant movement of weaponry and explosives from the Egyptian border, sometimes from the ocean, into Gaza. And our response has been to monitor the borders. We would prefer not to, but we do. And it's no doubt that it causes hardship for the Gazan population. But we have to find a way for huge munitions not to go back in there. Vis-a-vis Hezbollah, we don't have control of the Lebanese borders, and we can't control what's going on there. We simply maintain vigilance and belief in our own society. And the Israel Defense Forces are built in such a way as to defend us, ourselves, from aggression in that direction. Pakistan, well, that's a problem for other countries to deal with. We don't have relations with Islamabad. We would like, but we don't. And I don't think that we are the best ones to solve that problem. We wish the United States a lot of luck. It's very, very important to stabilize that country. But we've got our hands full.
I wanted to follow up on somebody else's question. And isn't it true that Hamas in Gaza controls what the media might be able to report on, like their launching of rockets from schools and hospitals? So the media, in effect, shies away a little bit from some of the reporting in Gaza because they don't like to be controlled?
I think that it's difficult to report from Gaza today for a number of reasons. First of all, the security situation in Gaza is poor. There's law and order is not very, very good. I would not say that Israel makes it easy for reporters to go in there. We make them take responsibility for their own safety. And, of course, we would prefer that news reports would focus on how Hamas behaved and how they behave and executions of Fatah political opponents and the use of ambulances and the use of hospitals and the firing of rockets from next to homes. But we will take things the way they are. We're willing to struggle in the media perception according to the rules of how things are. And I do fundamentally accept that for the most part, the press is trying to tell the truth, and we have to try to explain ourselves to the press. If they don't accept our explanations, sometimes there's a good reason, sometimes there's a poor reason, but that is the best mediation of reality that we have today.
Counsel General, the speaker last week showed a slide of a missile in an Israeli yard. And she said, this is where most of the missiles land that are coming from Palestine. How would you respond to that?
What did she mean to say by that, though?
She meant to say that there was no loss of life in Israel from these rockets. They all landed in empty yards.
Okay.
There's no harm.
Well, I would respond in the following way. Look, there were, since Israel left Gaza in 2005, that summer, and following that, there were 7,000 rockets launched from Gaza on the cities to the north of the Gaza Strip and to the kibbutz villages to the west. Eventually, capacities were developed to fire on Israel's one of Israel's largest cities, Beersheba, the city of over a million people in the south. I think we have a right to defend our citizens. And the fact that Hamas was firing missiles directly into civilian populations without the ability to aim it directly at a school does not mean that schools were not hit. And we were facing a situation where if we will allow this to happen, I mean, a government's fundamental job before building schools, before building hospitals, before universal health care, before any of those things, government's fundamental job is protection of the citizenry from violence from outside. And we were in a situation where the population of the city of Sderot was becoming depopulated because of rockets falling all over. And we did not, the Israeli government felt that it is its responsibility towards its citizenry to stop that violence.
What is the motivation behind the change of direction by the Turks? What does it mean strategically in the Middle East and globally? The country of Turkey, are they changing direction as far as relation with Israel? Where does it go, and what is the reason?
I don't know it.
You got to hold
the mic
closer to your mouth. With Turkey?
The question is, what is happening in Turkey? The question was asked in Hebrew. The question was, what is the going on in Israel-Turkey relations? The answer is nothing good. Nothing good. Our relations with Turkey are very important, but they're suffering. And we have to work hard to make them become better. Look, there was a change of government in Turkey 7 years ago. Turkey is a republic; it's a democracy, and the head of the government is the Islamic Party. They're more critical of us. They do not accept the way Israel fought the war in Gaza in December, January, and they're angry at us. We don't accept their criticism, and there was an angry exchange between our president Shimon Peres and their president at Davos. You can see it on YouTube. It's quite remarkable, but also kind of sad. We were supposed to have a joint air drill, and they did not allow the Israeli Air Force to participate. Now there was also, just on Turkish television, there was a drama in which they showed Israeli soldiers lining up Palestinians and executing them. And we summoned the Turkish ambassador because it was on Turkish state TV, and it's a lie. It's not true. It didn't happen. And our relations are not doing that great right now. Also, Turkey's coming closer to Syria. Generally, Syria, we're not at peace with Syria. Our relations with Turkey are often in order to isolate Syria. So that, I would say that part of Israel's diplomatic agenda is not going so well at this moment.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on your earlier answer to the question before this last one. How would you give us some numbers? Give us some numbers on the adult and children deaths between 2000 and 2008 for Israelis and Palestinians. And also, how would you compare the weaponry of each of those two parties in total, not just 7,000 rockets?
The answer is that Israel is far stronger and far more superior. And the answer is that more Palestinian children have been killed than Israeli children.
To Consul General, I'd like to thank you for your candid comments and addressing, obviously, a very complex, complex problem. Makes Alaska's problems look very simple. I think most in this audience and most Alaskans, our hearts would go with finding a solution. Where is there any hope? Where is the hope? Where can we least put our spirits behind to advance the moving towards the separate states, whatever you feel could move us away from this being on the precipice of nuclear warfare and just it seems to be generational hatred? Is there any hope that we can get behind?
Well, it's impossible to answer in the negative. First of all, we're not on a nuclear precipice. Iran does not have nuclear weaponry yet. And I focused on that because I think that's the most pressing issue today. And it's our view that the international community, if it will come together, can stop that. Vis-a-vis Israel's relations with the Arab world, it's complicated. I think that I don't know when we'll have relations with Saudi Arabia. I don't know if it'll happen in the next 50 years. It should, but I don't know if it will. I believe that we will reach peace between Israel and the Palestinian people. It tarries. We've had missteps. I think they've had more. But it will come because it is in the mutual interest of both peoples. And I would really urge some of the critics in the room who are, I think, are focus on all kinds of things that maybe the Jews, Israel, should not exist, to get past that. It's a decision of the international community that the Jewish people have a right to a state. And what we need to move now is to a fair accommodation between the two peoples. A fair accommodation between the two peoples will mean that children will not die, and that the life of Palestinians will be much better. The life of Israelis will be much better. We all have to work to get there. We can be critical. We can be critical of each other. But that has to be the direction that we try to get to. So I would like to thank everyone, the whole audience, and I would like to thank my critics and my supporters and those who just came to listen and haven't made up their mind. Thank you very much.
Consul General, thank you very much. And David, thank you for bringing them. We've enjoyed it, been very informative. And just so you can remember Alaska, we'd like to take that with you.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Next week, we have Professor Beeman, who will speak to us on our normal time on Friday noon here. His topic will be the future of U.S.-Iranian relations in the Obama era. Should be interesting. Hope to see you then. Thank you.